It happened on the same day that we were supposed to sign the APA again. Like, we can't even make this up. I remember waking up that morning to an email from the buyer saying, hey, we're looking forward to closing today at 2 o'clock or something like that.
Yeah.
And I saw my other emails from Amazon that was sent at 5 o'clock that morning to tell us our ASINs are down. Yep. It literally happened within 7 hours, the same day.
Yep. So it was sort of like we got this other problem behind us. We're feeling good. And literally the business, I mean, this couldn't have been any worse because it went basically to zero. They took down every SKU except for, I think, two or something like that. And they weren't top selling SKUs. So I think we went from like $12,000 a day to about $1,000 a day overnight.
Hi, folks. It's the Quiet Light Podcast with Joe Valley and Mark Dapps. Quiet Light Brokerage is the leader in helping entrepreneurs build, buy, and sell their online businesses. Since 2007, we have helped thousands buy and sell online businesses. And now, we're putting our extensive knowledge in your earbuds with our trademark relentless honesty and a few laughs along the way.
I always work when I'm sick.
We're impressed.
Get up, you! You give me 10 hours of work today.
I'm back in a few hours. I'll be up then.
And now, here's Joe and Mark.
All right, Joe, I know that Jason Yellowitz sold your business. I actually sold Jason's business before he came on board as a broker at Quiet Light Brokerage. And I often refer to the story of selling Jason's business to potential sellers to explain that sometimes when you're in the process of selling and getting closer to that closing date, anything that can go wrong will go wrong. And that happened with Jason's business. His business that he was selling these baby gates and dog gates, had the worst 3-day period of sales in its history. And of course, the buyer started freaking out, understandably so. But this happens with deals sometimes when you're in that due diligence period where all of a sudden all hell breaks loose and you kind of have to figure out what's going on. And I know you just went through an incredibly painful exit with a client who had that sort of scenario, but it worked out.
Yeah, and it wasn't painful for me necessarily because I'm at arm's length, so it was okay. But Janine, I think, stopped eating at one point. It was that incredibly painful. I remember I was at E-commerce Fuel down in Fort Worth this year, right? And we were about to close and something went wrong. And I don't want to give the details away here in the intro because you've got to listen to this. What could have gone wrong went wrong, and to the nth level. This is like deal killer, account closed, things are over, kind of gone wrong. But Brian and Janine, the owners of the business, remained level-headed, even though, like, when I called him from, you know, the ECF event, trying to cheer him up, I'm like, hey, how's it going today? We got over this hurdle. And I could hear it in his voice. Something else happened. Like, he was kicked when he was down on this second hurdle that we had to get over. And it was incredibly painful. That aside, these two are incredible people. They are pharmacists by trade. Janine has her PhD. She comes from a family with 6 children. 5 of the 6 have PhD. They're immigrants. They lived in the projects in Roxbury, Massachusetts. And it just an incredible story all around. Incredible story, incredible exit, incredibly painful with light at the end of the tunnel. And they're actually now under LOI buying another business. So it's a full story. They launched another brand, another business before they closed this transaction. So they're already generating another income stream. And now they found an opportunity where they're under LOI buying another business. And that's really within, you know, 60 days of closing loss transaction. So it's an incredible story all around.
That's fantastic. Let's get to it.
Hey folks, Joe Valley here from Quiet Light Brokerage. And we've got another incredible exits episode here. We've got Brian and Janine Lejeune on the call. Welcome, guys. How are you?
Good. How are you, Joe?
Very good, Joe.
Good. Now listen, we normally call this incredible exits, but I want to change that for this episode. We'll call it the incredibly painful exit for you guys, because there were certain components of it that were incredibly challenging and painful. And I think at one point, Janine, you might have stopped eating if Brian was telling the
truth. Stopped eating and I stopped sleeping.
Well, good. Let's get a little bit of background on you first. You guys are both pharmacist by training, I believe, right?
Yep. That's right.
Yep. I have mom with a doctorate degree, though. He's only got like a normal degree.
So I need to call you Dr. Janine?
Yes.
Dr. J? How's that?
There's just more responsibility that comes with that. I keep telling her on a plane when they ask for, is there a doctor in the house?
It's a PhD, right? Or is it? So I have a father-in-law that has his PhD, and he said it just stands for piled higher and deeper.
Yeah. That sounds about right. $200,000 in student loan debts when I graduated.
200?
200,000, yeah.
How incredibly painful. Have you paid that off with the sale of your business?
We're going to, but right now the stock market, do some fun stuff. We're putting some money there.
Cool. Good for you. All right. Well, let's get the background. And Brian, let's start with you because okay. You know, honestly, Janine's story is much more interesting. So I just want to get this out of the way.
Yeah.
What's your story background, business history, offline business, and then online, I believe, right?
Yeah. So pretty typical in the entrepreneur journey, kind of been dabbling in a lot of things for a lot of years. You know, I went to college, came out, became a pharmacist. That's what, you know, that was the path I took. But even in college, kind of always entrepreneurial, just always looking for other opportunities. I think about maybe 2 years into pharmacy, I started saying, okay, I don't think this is quite what I want to do for the rest of my life. So I started looking at businesses, looking at local businesses. Bought my first business when I was about 26, 27 years old. It was a tanning salon. Knew absolutely nothing about the industry. I was honestly just looking for a business. It was 5 minutes from my house. Learned as much as I could from it and kind of grew it to a really nice level where I was actually able to leave pharmacy completely. And left pharmacy for about 7-8 years. And in that span, opened up other salons, pulled some partners in, did some distributorships, did a lot of like brick and mortar type stores. Bought some, sold some, but have never sold them at the correct time. Always kind of past its peak, like, oh, we should sell or something's going wrong with the partner. And always getting out, not at the ideal.
A little too late.
Right. Yeah. So that was a big thing that looking at what we did, that was my one goal. Like, let's do this at the right time. You know, you never know when the perfect time is, but you just don't want to do it the wrong time.
Yeah. True. When did you jump into the online space?
Online, in terms of jumping in, probably not till like 2014, but a lot of little things here and there, trying to start blogs, trying to sell things, eBay, whatever. But that was very, very small. It was always kind of like what can I do next? What can I do next? But 2014, 2015, kind of found the Amazon space.
Was this before or after the young lady sitting beside you, the two of you met?
Yeah, so before, but honestly, I owe a lot to her because didn't really get super deep into it until she came along for sure.
Well, she does have her PhD. She's a lot smarter.
Yeah, it takes me.
Obviously smarter.
I think it just takes me a little longer, maybe. Yeah.
Let's hear a little of your background, Janine, and do me a favor and just tell everybody about the generation before you, because I think you've got a fascinating family story as well.
Yeah, sure. So my family came here in 1989. My dad was 35 years old at the time. 7 kids, pregnant wife. No money, no English whatsoever.
What country did you come from?
We came from Vietnam.
Okay.
Yeah, so you know, he fought with the American soldiers during the Vietnam War. He was, of course, against the communist people. So they put him in jail. Things were just getting pretty rough for us back there. And we get the opportunity to come to this country, and he decided to take the chance. So we came here in 89. He was 35. He was making minimum wage, raising a family of a pregnant wife and 7 kids.
Ranging
from age, so fetus, to I think 17 or 18 years old, maybe even a little younger than that.
Any idea how much money the family had when you came to the country?
Oh, we had nothing. Not even like a ring that's worth anything besides the clothes on our backs. We had nothing at all. Like, my mom didn't own anything that was worth anything, you know, no heirloom ring or just nothing like that. So we relied a lot on government help at the time. We spent 10 to 12 years in the projects.
In what city?
Roxbury.
In Roxbury, okay. Yeah. I spent some time up on Mission Hill myself.
Do you know Dudley Station and Royal Station?
Sure.
So yeah. I was 5 minutes walking distance from Dudley Station. That's the highest crime-ridden place you can think of, Massachusetts.
Wow.
Yeah, that was how I grew up.
And you did this and managed to have how many PhDs in your family now with all the siblings that you have?
So we have a dentist, 4 pharmacists, and 3 bachelor degrees and 1 master's. So some of us has more than one.
A true, true, incredible American success story. That's incredible. Yeah. No excuses to my kids or now your kids that, second, third, fourth, fifth generation Americans that don't want to do the hard work that you guys did. So
it's tough. It's tough to teach them, you know. I don't know how to impart the same wisdom on them that my father did for us.
Yeah.
But when I was little, he used to tell me, if we see someone who's homeless on the street, he's like, you see that? If you don't do good in school, that's where you're going to end up. And it freaked me out. And I actually believed him. I actually believed him. So growing up, we were always doing good in school, every one of us. So I was top of my class since grade school.
Wow. Yeah. And you still married Brian. That's amazing.
Yeah. I don't know how this guy got me into it.
All right, folks, I know these guys pretty well at this point. We've gone through a lot together. So, yes, I like to give them both a hard time because they give it back to me as well. So, all right. So your online entrepreneurial journey, you're a pharmacist, you got a PhD, but at some point you and Brian met. Did you already have online businesses before you met Brian, or did you jump into the space once you guys met?
Yeah. So since I was 16, right, my parents opened a restaurant, and that's when things kind of got better for my family. And so I saw the opportunity of what having a business would mean. I mean, literally, he opened a restaurant and 2 years later, we moved out of the projects. We bought a house. He bought his brand new Lexus, something he's always wanted for a long time. So from that, I see the incredible opportunity of owning a business. But I also saw how much it consumed my parents. So they're always there. That's all they talked about. And they're literally there. Sometimes my dad's there 4 in the morning to make this broth that takes 6 hours to cook. So I see how much it consumed them. So I saw the opportunity in business, but didn't like the brick and mortar aspect of it. They were always gone. They were always there. So I stumbled on eBay when I was 18 years old in college. So this is 2002. I was struggling with money. So I looked around my room. Whatever was worth selling, I put on eBay. And whatever I could get $10 for, I would do it because poor college student, typical story. Yeah. That's kind of how I got into the whole online space. And I just never left. I saw the opportunity. I was trying all kinds of things over the next 15 years. I did affiliate marketing. I tried selling cell phones. I tried selling used books, shoes. I did affiliate marketing, just all kinds of things. And they made me decent side income, but just not enough to replace a full-time job. And then when I became a pharmacist, making over $100,000 a year, it became harder to justify that $20 or $30 I'm making on this side business. And then I met this guy who told me about FBA. I didn't know anything about it. It was the first time I heard of the word private label. I had no idea what that meant. Mm-hmm. So he explained it to me. We bought ASM. I think you had ASM 3.
I had ASM.
Yep. So got that. And that's how our journey began.
It was the private label route that really kind of changed things, because both of us were always maybe selling other people's products or, always looking for that next thing to sell. Whereas it was okay, we can develop our own brand. And I had sort of done this in the tanning salon world. We were private labeling back in early 2000, a line of skincare that we would bring into the salon and sell. Then we started doing tanning beds, and we basically brought some tanning beds in from Italy. We put our own name on them and we started selling them to other salons. So I'd kind of been familiar with it, but the Amazon thing really opened my eyes to kind of okay, we can do something really big. The volume is incredible. Get a good product, get a good brand, and just try to blow it up. And fortunately it worked out.
And you learned both of the initial stuff through ASM 3, I think you said it was.
Yep.
That's a while ago, right? Several years ago, many variations since then. If somebody's new coming into the space and let's say they're at a pharmacist working, listening to this podcast right now, what would you suggest they listen to, courses that they take, masterminds that they join, anything that you can recommend?
I think the most important thing is to take action. There's a lot of courses out there right now. And I remember I heard one of the guys spoke on stage and he was like, so this is speaking to the ASM crowd who all paid like, you know, a lot of money to be there. And he said, I know 95% of you here today aren't going to take action. And I sat there and I thought to myself, that's so weird. Who the hell would spend that kind of money, spend that kind of time to go there and not take action? I thought there was no way that that's true because I knew that there's no chance in hell that I wouldn't be taking action. But then over the years, I learned that he was right. Yep. People just aren't taking action. They buy these courses and in their brain, it's kind of like they check it off as done. I did it. Kind of like the same thing with when someone signs up for a gym membership in their brand. It has a dopamine release of you actually going to the gym, even though you didn't. All you did was bought the membership. It's like this psychological experiment that I read about. So a lot of people buy courses and in their brand, it's checked off as, hey, I did it. The most important thing is just really to take action.
No matter which course, whatever it is, just take some action, figure it out, get started, and learn from that experience. Okay. So the business that we worked together on that you sold through Quiet Light is in the electronic space. Is this the largest business that you had gotten off the ground and launched?
Yes, definitely.
Okay. All right. Let's talk about that process a little bit. When did you first launch this particular business?
So that would have been the last quarter of 2016.
And did you
use any? Yeah, that's correct.
Yeah. Okay. Did you use any particular tools to research the niche, like a Jungle Scout or Helium 10 or anything like that?
Helium 10 at that time.
Helium 10 at that time. Okay. Yep. Do you recall how much your initial order was? How much you spent on the first batch of products?
1,000 units. So that would have been
about $10,000. Yeah. Give or take.
Yeah.
Okay. Did you have the money in the bank for that? Did you have debt and use a credit card? What was your financial situation then?
Well, at the time, I was working overtime, whatever overtime I could. So I literally sat there and mapped out how many hours can I work overtime, how many hours did I work, and all that money gets put into the business because I can justify to myself that I'm not risking my quote-unquote own money. This is extra money.
Yeah.
So I was driving for Uber. I was doing like side stuff. I was doing all kinds of crazy things. It was like the second order that I had to use credit card and some loans.
How long did it take between, well, let's actually back up. When you got the first 10,000 units, 1,000 units, $10,000, how quickly did things take off for you? When did you start to see sales and then how quickly did you go, oh boy, we need to order more?
It just started selling.
Yeah, that one started selling really good, but it's a little bit unfair to call it like that's when we started because both of us had products before that time that were marginally successful in the sense that they would sell, but neither one of us could make the products profitable. Okay. You know, so we got to decent volumes of, you know, we could sell 15, 20, 25 a day type of thing, but spending more on PPC than we were, getting in, and it never kind of went over that hump. Whereas with the electronic product that actually Janine launched, it was up to 20, 30 units a day almost immediately. So it was we sat there, we're looking, okay, what do we do next? And she was trying to figure out, because there wasn't, you know, a big bank account that had all this money ready to go to invest. So she says, okay, I think if I buy 1,000 now and then I save up and I buy 1,000. And she had this literally a whole path of what she wanted to do. And we sat there, we're at an ice cream shop, and I said, no, that's not how you do it. You need $100,000. We need to do a big order. Like, that's it. This product is going to work. You could see it. It didn't take a lot of effort. It got bigger and bigger every day. And then it was loans and credit cards and scrounging. And
I thought he was insane.
He won that argument. He won the argument of no, let's spend
$100,000. You know, I'm sitting there, I'm like, where do you think I'm going to get $100,000? Like, what kind of overtime do you think I can work? And at that point, I'd already quit my job. But I knew that he was right, you know. And this is why our partnership works really, really well. It's that he already knows how the business world works, whereas I'm kind of new to it. And business, whether you run a brick and mortar, like a tanning salon, or an online, the principles are the same. The cash flow principles, how to allocate money, how to leverage debt, those principles don't change no matter what business you're in. So, and I agree with him, even though it would never occur to me to do it. he brought it up and I thought he was right. So I literally spent one day, because you know, when you apply for a loan, credit cards know about it and they're more likely to reject you. So I had one day off of work. I sat there and applied for every single credit card that I could think of and applied for every single loan that I could think of. And I scrounged around and between credit cards, new credit cards, and a cabbage loan, I was able to come up with $100,000.
Wow.
You actually pulled the trigger.
I actually raised
$100,000 through. So we have a lot of people that say, how do I raise capital? How do I do, you know, buy a business and raising capital? You just found $100,000 through cabbage and multiple credit cards. Just like that.
And I kind of told her, I said, money's not the hard part. That's the easy part. I think we can all figure out a way to get money, whether it's borrowing from, you know, family if you have to, or credit cards, whatever. The hard part was done. Like, she found the product.
You found the product. So getting to the point where you're
getting the money is always easier. Yeah.
Okay. That's interesting. I'm mentoring some students at a local college here, and they had a hard time finding money to incorporate.
Right.
And they need to listen to this podcast and do what you guys did. I said to them, I said, come on, look around, just sell something. It's easy to do. Come on.
Right. I think a lot of people get stuck on the, I have to set up this first. I need a corporation. I need a logo. I need business cards. And all of that is way overrated. I think people use that as sort of a stalling mechanism. You know, they need to get things set up. They need to be ready. And it's not true. It's sell something first and figure out the other stuff after.
I think I was at $1 million before I had a corporation, before I was properly set up for like a lot of things. Like,
yeah,
I don't think I even had a domain. I didn't even have a .com. I had no email sequence. I had no email list. Didn't have a brand. Didn't have a Shopify presence. I didn't have any business card. I don't know why people keep asking me for one. And you know, our packaging was literally this box that had that in the background. Had a bunch of textbooks and it all said Cinderella on it.
Oh.
It looks like someone just kind of like drove something together.
It was a stock box from the manufacturer.
And and just for the record, Cinderella had absolutely nothing to do with the product, folks.
Nothing
at all.
No.
But my point is, you know, sometimes you get stuck on these things. Oh, I have to get the packaging right. I have to design this, design that. I got to get a domain. I have to brand register and all these things. I didn't do any of that until I was already well over $1 million.
All of it's important, but if you get stuck on doing that before you actually have something to sell,
never get out of the game.
Long path, exactly.
I'm curious. You had said you had each tried multiple things and you didn't get past 15 or 20 units a day.
Mm-hmm.
Were they all in the same seller account as this one, or separate seller accounts? How did you manage that aspect of it with what we always recommend, separate brands for separate seller accounts?
Yeah. So at that time, we both had our own seller accounts. But then the one that we ended up building with was the one she had set up. And there were multiple products in there and they were
totally unrelated.
Totally unrelated. A lot of like, it became like test products. So like, finally found the one that stuck, and then that became the brand phased out. Yep.
Okay. Yep. Okay. So the biggest challenge you would say is actually finding the right product and getting it to work, and don't let yourself get stuck in the gate, trying to get everything perfectly set up before doing that.
That, and also I don't want our story to make people feel like, oh, I need $100,000 or, oh, I need 10 grand. Otherwise I can't get started. That's like totally not true.
Yeah.
If I hadn't had four products that failed, if I hadn't had four products where I spent all my time, you know, all the things I learned, photography, how to talk to freelancers, going to fiverr.com to hire people, how to write a good listing, how to use Helium 10, how to use all kinds of software. I learned all of that with all those products that cost me like $1, $1.20. I only started with $300. So that's where I learned all of those skills. So when the right product comes along, I'm ready to go, you know?
Yeah.
And I think that's contributed a lot to our success. I imagine if my very first product was the successful product, maybe I wasn't ready for it. And maybe we wouldn't have been on the trajectory that we were. So even if you have $300 to buy something that costs $1 or $2, you may not make money on it. Do it.
Just an education.
Education, right. You're learning along the way.
Yeah.
$100 is worth it.
Okay, so lots of failure, or enough failure, or mediocre success before you had the home run, the seven-figure eventual exit, so to speak. So you found a way to raise money, not an issue for you. As the business continued to grow, were there challenges with cash flow management, trying to keep up with more and more inventory demands? While you don't have a job anymore, Janine, you know, you don't have income. Talk to me about those challenges and how you overcame them.
Yeah, there was definitely challenges. But it became, so she had left her job. I was still working for about a year. So I left in end of 2018. So now neither one of us work in pharmacy. But during 2018, when the real growth really started to happen, it was always a struggle to order enough to grow, because we're growing 30, 40, 50%, you know, month over month. It wasn't slowing down. So it was always trying to stay one step ahead with inventory. We used Amazon lending extensively. So, I mean, we started with the smallest they offered, you know, $1,000 loan. We took it. And then every time we paid it off, the loan got bigger and bigger.
Do you always have to wait for them to offer in a way that you can
do? Yeah. Yeah. Okay. And as far as I know, the offer is the offer. There's no getting any more.
But you think take it and pay it off, and then you're going to get a lot.
Yeah, it was really stupid. Yeah. The first loan for $1,000, that wouldn't have done anything for us. We were already doing, I can't remember the exact number, but at least maybe 50 or 60 grand a month, maybe even a lot more than that. So I remember looking at it and thinking to myself, what the hell is this going to do? Like, why is Amazon giving us such a cheap ass loan, like $1,000? But we took it, and it went to 10 grand, and it went to 70, and it went to 300,000, 500,000. It ended at over 800,000. It just gets bigger and bigger.
Wow.
So if you get offered, even if it's $500, $100, take it.
Yeah. And they're short-term loans, so they're expensive to have on your books, but it allowed us to fund the inventory and fund the growth, and it worked out well. Like, going back, there would be no other way to grow the company so when we sold, it was almost at 5 million a year.
Wow. Okay. Let's get to the niche itself and the incredible painful exit, as opposed to just the incredible. It's incredible. No question about it. The whole story is amazing and inspiring, and hopefully it's going to get people from, you know, in that starting gate to getting out of it and taking some action, looking around the room and selling whatever they have to, working more hours. I remember when I was a kid, I was complaining that, you know, I didn't have enough money, and it was kind of to the millionaire next door, best friend of my parents. Never know that they are, but they were. And I worked for the company, and I said to Stan, I'm like, Stan, yeah. Or I said at some point, I was in the room complaining. I think probably as my parents were playing Chinese checkers with him, which they did all the time. And he said, just stop your whining. There's plenty of work. Just go work more hours.
Right.
There's lots to do. Work more hours.
Yep.
And that's exactly, you know, what you did, Janine. You did the math on how to work more hours so that you can fund that $10,000 purchase. So no excuses, people. If you want to be an entrepreneur, that's what you got to do. All right. So why the electronics space? It's a space that we talk about in terms of risk, and that's risk of obsolescence. And took me a long time to learn to pronounce that, but it means that there's a fear that the product will be outdated someday in the future with changes and updates. So why the electronic space? What attracted you to that?
I don't think there was a lot of thought as to that we want to go into electronics. So it just came from product research and finding a good volume product that didn't seem to have a ton of competition, that seemed to be somewhat new in the marketplace with already a lot of volume. So it kind of checked all the boxes that we're looking for. Also, there's a lot of training, and there's a lot of categories, there's a lot of products, there's a lot of things that they tell everybody to avoid. We tend to, especially now that we've developed a better skill set around this, we have more confidence. We do the opposite of times. Don't always avoid, because guess what? I mean, the space is already crowded, but the things that everyone's not avoiding, everyone's in those. So the ones that they say don't avoid, and maybe it's an oversize, maybe it's electronics, if it still seems like a good opportunity, go for it.
Take it.
You know, I don't like to use like a definitely do not do this. Like,
okay.
Yeah.
All right. So launched in 2016, doing $1 million in revenue before you ever incorporated. At what point from your experience of selling too late, at what point did you say to yourself, okay, we're going to exit this. We're going to talk to me, talk to Joe, talk to somebody and learn about the process of selling the business. How long was it and how far in advance do you think other people should consider the exit process or the training or planning, as it's called?
Yeah. Well, they always say day one, right?
Yeah, but nobody ever does that.
No one does.
Yeah.
I think as soon as you know that you have a business. So, I mean, it can't be day one because maybe that's never going to go anywhere. But as soon as you sort of maybe feel traction, you've kind of built the brand, it's still growing and you see like an upside to it, maybe start planning. Definitely from the day one, keep your books good. That was a major thing.
But do you remind me, did you use QuickBooks or Xero?
We use QuickBooks.
And did you outsource to a bookkeeper eventually? Or did you do that yourself?
Eventually. So we were doing it. I was doing it myself. And then when we sat down with you, that was kind of one of the things you helped us with. So
okay.
We used CapForge. They were awesome. So they went back and had to, you know, recast all the books to the accrual method. So that was a little long, tedious, painful.
Yep.
Probably more expensive in hindsight, you know, and doing it that way than to just keeping it correctly from the start. But yeah, I think just planning is always better, of course, right? So as soon as you think you have a business, I think you should at least have it on your radar, because who knows? I mean, we're all in this to make money. You own a business to make money. And if selling it is going to make you money, that should be part of your plan.
Yeah. So yeah. One of the things I would just try to shift everybody's mindset, everybody's always called it, you know, plan to sell your business, you know, the day that you start it, and exit planning, flip it and call it training, because you're learning. You're constantly learning by your failures in launching new products until you hit that right last one that launched, you know, a seven-figure exit. Think about the exit planning as training as well. If you're going to run a marathon, you've got to train for it, or you're never going to get out of the gate. You've got to learn about the process. You're listening to this podcast, so that's a great start. Get a valuation. Look at other listings and how they're valued and how the packages are put together. Train as much as you can. Don't make it your sole focus and your mission, but make it part of your overall business plan and operating your business so that you can eventually exit before you get burned out and things turn the wrong way and it's too late to exit at a strong value.
Yeah. I think the idea was initially planted in our heads when we had our initial conversation with Ezra from our mastermind group. And that brings me to another point, the importance of having a mastermind. Brian and I are always a part of a mastermind. Sometimes we're in two different masterminds. Right now I'm in three different masterminds, but having a group of people that you can talk to is like super duper important. So Ezra, we talked to him, he planted the idea in our head. We connected with you, we get the initial phone call with you. I love that you were not pushy at all. It was just very informative, very casual. We had a talk with you. And we got off that day and we decided, yeah, we're going to do this. And it took us 6 months to get everything set up, all the books properly correct, but you know, it's never too late.
And like you said about an education, going through the process, I think allows you to learn how to run the business better anyways. So even if you were to keep it, you should be in a better position after going through it.
I agree 100%.
Before. Even going through the sale, there were things that we learned. So during due diligence, it's like you get asked a question or someone else organizes information a different way. And you say to yourself, oh, I wish we did that before. But now guess what? We do it next time. So our next business, we set up a little differently because of things we learned by being exposed to the process.
Right. So how much did you make more money on the exit than you made while you were running the business?
Yes.
50%, yeah, 50% of all the money you ever made, 90%?
Cash flow is a funny thing. So, I mean, there's a lot of money flowing through our business, but in terms of, you know, what you end up with, yeah, I definitely think the exit, I don't know, percentage, but yeah, a big amount of what we actually ended up with was from the sale.
Total earnings.
Every month, I'm like, where's our money?
Yeah.
You know, we had like 300,000, 400,000 monthly sales. But I'm always like, where's all our money?
Where's the money?
Where's all the money?
Yeah.
And
yeah, we'd laugh as we'd wire money. We're like, Chinese, they're taking all our money. I'm like, why do you keep sending it to them? But yeah.
Right. So the exit is when the cash really came to our bank. Yeah, definitely.
And it comes at a lower tax bracket too. Because
it does, which is incredible. Yeah.
Very, very helpful. All right, let's talk about the painful part of the exit. So we were a couple of days away from signing an asset purchase agreement with your buyer. The CFO of the company bought your product and his wife plugged it in and it started to smoke and catch on fire.
Kind of. I don't think it caught on fire. It just smoked.
Just smoked. Okay. Yeah. Minor technicality.
Yeah. And it was not a few days before close. It was literally
the day of
that we're supposed to close. Yeah.
When details in your life are incredibly painful, you remember them very, very well. You guys probably remember exactly where you were when you got that email or phone call, I imagine, as well. But we overcame that. We were able to sort of get over that hurdle, get around that hurdle. Can you address how that was overcome?
Yeah, so the exact how. So we had a lot of confidence in our product and in our business. And we didn't feel that the buyer had that same confidence. And I think that's normal, right? So they don't know exactly what they're getting. There's always going to be maybe some reservations, especially like you were talking, it's electronic product, obsolescence, safety hazards type of thing. But we had kind of, we'd built it. We had huge volume. And of course we had problems along the way that we were always able to overcome and solve. And every time we overcame them and solved them, the company just continued to grow and grow and grow. So all that I felt was like, I just need them to believe in us, believe in the product. And we restructured the deal to make them feel a little bit more comfortable. We were willing to take a little bit more of the risk on some contingent payments. But we're completely willing and confident to do that because we kind of know where I think this product will go. And the company that bought that, I think, can grow it, you know, way beyond where we would. So we just needed to kind of instill into them that we're confident, so we'll take some more risk. And I think it worked out. I think it was a really good negotiation.
Yeah, I think they've done well with it. They started to grow it immediately after closing. And with COVID, more people staying home, more people are buying that particular product anyway. So it's a double whammy for them. So what you did was shifted some of the risk into contingent payments, meaning that you got paid 3 months out if things were stable or 6 months out on another payment. Yep. You also shared some statistics too, though, in terms of, you know, the total number of complaints you had in that regard.
Right.
And then I think they did a little research in terms of looking at other similar products in similar categories and seeing that, you know, complaints were pretty similar and in some cases even higher. So
even like major brands have the same problems, you know, Apple, Google, Samsung had that fiasco with the cell phones, with the battery exploding on airplanes or something.
Yep.
It's not unique to our product.
Right. And I think that's what we just needed to kind of work through and make them feel more comfortable, you know.
And you did it with logic and you know, level emotion. You didn't go off the rails, you didn't scream and shout, you didn't threaten.
Yeah.
Well, you did that with Brian. You didn't do it.
Yeah.
You didn't do it with the buyer.
Yeah. I'm very patient I'm very patient and I don't give up. And I knew it could be solved. I knew it was something we could overcome. I was confident the whole
time. I thought it was over.
Yeah.
I was depressed. I wasn't eating. I thought it was over. And this guy, very level-headed, sat on his computer, thought about it, sent out an email, negotiating, and they accepted it.
They did. They loved the logical approach and that you put some risk on you. At the end of the day, you're still going to get paid out. But you said, okay, look, I'm willing to take some risk just to prove to you that this is not an issue. But the next problem, it's almost one that could never be overcome. So I remember I was at the e-commerce fuel event down in Fort Worth and I pick up the phone, check in with you, Brian. I'm like, hey, man, how you doing? You were like, yeah, I'm not so good. I'm like, come on, we're getting close. We're almost there. He's like, well, we just got hit with an IP infringement and all the ASINs are down or all the top ASINs are down.
Yep.
So someone else ended up getting issued a utility patent on
design patent.
Design patent on the primary SKU of your hero SKU, essentially, because you had pretty much a hero SKU here. How did that feel?
So this is on it happened on the same day that we were supposed to sign the APA again. Like, we can't even make this up. I remember waking up that morning to an email from the buyer saying, hey, we're looking forward to closing today at 2:00 or something like that.
Yeah.
And I saw my other emails from Amazon that was sent at 5:00 that morning to tell us our ASINs are down. Yep. It literally happened within 7 hours, the same day.
Yep. So it was sort of like we got this other problem behind us. We're feeling good. And literally the business, I mean, this couldn't have been any worse because it went basically to zero. They took down every SKU except for, I think, two or something like that. And they weren't top selling SKUs. So I think we went from like $12,000 a day to about $1,000 a day overnight. And no path to see it being fixed.
None whatsoever. It's a utility patent issued by the US government. Janine, did you say those emails came in from your buyer and from Amazon within about 7 minutes of each other?
7 hours.
7 hours of each other. So 7 hours and the loss of seven figures. Mm-hmm. Pretty painful. You were pretty down in the basically like you got kicked somewhere that would hurt really bad, Brian. I remember talking to you. But again, level-headedness. You reached out to your Chinese manufacturer. You looked at the dates. You looked at the history. You looked at whether or not this patent was issued legitimately or fraudulently, meaning the guy didn't fully share everything with the U.S. government, the USTPO, that he should have. Mm-hmm. What did you find when you did all that research?
So he had sort of, after the fact, applied for a patent. So we had the product selling in the marketplace first, but there were others. So it was shortly after us where there was maybe five or six of us all selling similar design, same exact product. It never even really crossed our mind that it was a patentable thing because we didn't design it. We purchased it as a private label thing, had our logos put on it, did the packaging, yada, yada, yada. So did this other buyer. So did lots of other buyers. About a year, so after we're, already over $1 million, he applied for design patent. The path he took was
sketchy.
Yeah, a little bit devious, claiming rights to something that he really didn't have rights to. There was prior art in the, on the space. So, but none of that sort of matters in the Amazon world because he did actually get granted the patent. And Amazon is not going to rule on whether or not that patent is valid or not. One thing that I did quickly was contacted some of our other competitors. So almost immediately, I think we emailed.
They were also taken down.
Yeah. So we tried to reach out to to our competitor that took us down, but then got no response. And I reached out to other competitors and we kind of all worked together. We're all doing our own research. We all had our own lawyers. And I think that little pact that we formed in the end helped as well. Cause it was a lot of us working together, even though we're competitors, we kind of all had one thing to solve. And 3 weeks, four. I mean, this was a lot worse than the first thing. So this one actually took a lot of time.
14 days.
Yeah.
It appeared by all imagination as something completely insurmountable. But,
right.
But you did. You banded together with your competitors. You also reach out to your manufacturer to reach out to them and
right.
put a little pressure on them as well.
Yep.
And you eventually got in touch with the patent holder.
Yep.
Cutting this short a little bit and telling the whole story because it's long, folks, and it was painful. A lot of emails back and forth, a lot of negotiations, a lot of, okay, I'll think about this and I'll get back to you, and then not hearing back for days on end.
And I got on the phone with him. I actually was able to speak to him and tried to work it out as just, two businesses like competing in the same world. It didn't seem like it was going anywhere. It wasn't working, but it did finally. Cooler heads prevailed. And
so at one point that conversation led to, okay, I will allow Amazon to put your stuff back up. And that's good. So your stuff was back up and selling on Amazon, but your buyer really wasn't willing to close because that issue was still out there, that this person had the patent and they could shut you down at any time. We worked with a buyer who was very good about being patient, understanding and all this. A lot of buyers would have just walked away. In this situation, they hung out, they hung around, they trusted you guys. They saw the commitment you were willing to put in by putting some risk on your side. And they said, see if you can work it out, we're good. And one of the other things that you did is you said, look, we will backdate this asset purchase agreement. Let's go ahead and get the APA signed contingent on getting a mutual release of the ability to sell the product now and forever on any platform and being able to transfer control of that right to sell the product as well. But backdate it. I think we ended up closing in March, but we backdated the, you said effective, I think January 31st, as far as the asset purchase agreement. So you were essentially managing the business, not taking any money out of it. And if we were able to close the transaction, you essentially had ended up managing it for the buyers for 45 days or so. So again, you're putting yourself out there saying, look, we're here, we're going to fix this and we're going to, it's yours as of that date back there, but we're going to run it until this problem is solved. And we did. We ended up with a mutual release letter. There was the strangest possible clause in a legally binding contract I've ever seen. We won't go into the exact details, but the buyer's attorney said, I don't think this is enforceable. And I said, really? Exclamation point. Absolutely. Just a little clause that this person needed to make himself feel better, perhaps in the afterlife. And we don't know if you could enforce that in the afterlife or not. But the key is that you worked with him closely to accommodate his personal needs and your own personal needs. And you got through it. You remained level-headed. And at the end of the day, you wound up with a seven-figure exit. I want to know how you felt. Not when we finally got that release letter, but I want to know how it felt when that the first wire eventually hit your account.
Yeah.
It couldn't happen. You know, so right now we're going through COVID-19. I don't know if you remember, but March 17 was when the stock market dropped by like 20%. The whole country woke up. Stock market was down like 20% or more. And that was the same day we got our seven figure finally hitting our bank.
This couldn't have closed at a better time. I mean, it put us in such a good position. You know, obviously we had been waiting for it for a long time. So it was a relief, but timing was just incredible.
Although the buyers seen a spike in sales because of it.
No, they've seen, I mean, we of course follow it very closely.
I don't know how they're doing it.
I think they're up over 100%. I mean, they're growing. It's awesome. Yep. They're growing the way we thought they would. You know, they have the capital to put behind it. They got a good, strong team to put behind it. So, I mean,
Are you excited for them? Are you glad? You just said it's awesome.
Oh, it's so awesome. Yeah.
Right. So folks, that's the mentality. That's the mentality that will get you a better value and a better deal and a better transaction Brian and Janine ran this business and created something that would be great for a buyer to take over. Mm-hmm. And a buyer saw that, took it over, and now it's up over 100%. Yes, COVID's having an impact, but even without COVID, it would be up substantially. That is absolutely the right mindset to have.
Yeah, because to see it like that brand, even if we potentially could grow it to say $10, $20, $30 million brand, I honestly don't think we wanted to. Like that wasn't our goal. Like we didn't want to have to leverage ourselves to get there, take the extra time.
Things were getting scary.
Yeah, like we built the business to be kind of a lifestyle brand. We travel all the time. We have a lot of flexibility. In order to take it to the next level, we knew that we'd have to sacrifice a lot on that.
And hire more people, more agencies, more things that would mean that we need to spend more time on it. And that wasn't our goal.
Right. So to see them be able to do that, of course, we would we would love it. We'd still feel that same pride that it was ours and we built it. Like, you know, she was always like, this is my baby. I don't want to give it up. But, you know, no, you kick the baby out of the house eventually. So, no, it is.
You have awesome. You have a new baby. It's got seven figures.
Yeah. That's
right. And we are in the process of trying to buy another one.
Right. Right. So, yeah. So you guys did something smart that is interesting. You know, was it Blue Ribbon? Yeah. We were at Blue Ribbon Mastermind in St. Pete. And you had already, we hadn't closed on this yet. We were still working out the details and you had already launched another product on Amazon, separate seller account. You launched something new. And I think at that point you're already up to 20 or 30 sales a day, which I think is, it's brilliant. This business model that you're in, has you be able to build, sell, repeat, build, sell, repeat, and continue to do it with the skill set that you have. So I think it's fantastic. It's the exitpreneur process. You all know I write in the book. That's a little plug for my book. Mm-hmm. But it's brilliant. I'm so excited and pleased for you guys. It's been a privilege, honestly, getting to know you, spending some time with you out in Seattle, having you get to meet my son. We had lunch together with Bronson, and then getting to spend more time down at Blue Ribbon Mastermind. Congratulations. I think it's fantastic what you guys have done. And I hope that people hearing the story from both your angles and approaches will inspire some of them to look around the room and sell something, others to have the chutzpah that you had to raise $100,000 because you knew you had a winner. Pretty incredible all around. Any last thoughts or words of wisdom that either of you would like to share with potential listeners, both buyers and sellers of online businesses?
Well, you know, Amazon is kind of like a world where we are kind of secretive about what our product is. Some of us won't even divulge what our category is. And it's like that for a reason, but it doesn't mean you can't have a mastermind. It doesn't mean you can't network with people. And that was like one of the most important things that we did. And also going through the process that we did with the IP infringement made me realize, you know what? We're not like big companies competing against each other. We're all families, we have kids, we have a mortgage, all of us are the same. So a lot of these life hack strategies where you're kind of doing something to gain a competitive edge by sort of hurting another person, you know, really just don't do it, because at the end of the day, you're hurting another person who's probably just like you, married with kids, probably with a student loan or a mortgage, you don't know. And I think we got through to the patent holder with our issue because we made him see that. And he's also a family guy, religious man, of course. And I think getting to know them and seeing that we're just another family, just like him, that's how we got through to him. So that's, you know.
And some of his actions were, and when we got on the phone, we were actually able to talk about this. I couldn't so much fault him exactly for what he did, because we're all business people. We're all kind of doing things to get an edge. And if that's what he felt he needed to get an edge, it's almost hard to fault him for that, but it was making him realize that, hey, you know, we're not some Fortune 500 company. We're just like you. We're working out of our house. We have a family. You know, this is our business.
And at the end of the day, he saw that because
he did.
You released each other.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You took care of each other as competitors and rivals, and gave each other the opportunity to continue to grow in business.
Yeah, Amazon's so big. You know, there's room for everyone.
Agreed.
Yeah, there definitely is.
Guys, I feel like I could honestly talk with you for another hour and a half. Maybe we'll have you back on with your next incredible exit. But thank you so much for sharing your story and giving me the opportunity to work with you.
Thank you, Joe.
Thank you, Joe.
Today's podcast was produced by Podcast Motor and the Quiet Light Content Team. If you have a suggestion for a future podcast, or if you want to guess the quote from the beginning of the show for a chance at getting a shout out on the pod, email us at podcast@quietlightbrokerage.com. Be sure to follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook, and subscribe to our YouTube channel and this show wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week.